Okay, we're going to do the same as the other week. I'm going to begin without the pictures, and the technician is on his way, and he's going to try to fix that. Last week, then, I looked at Wales, the conquest of Wales, and the different stages of Welsh identity, especially focused around the language. And although the conquest of Wales, like most conquests, was probably rather violent, it was a long time ago. Today, I'm going to look at Ireland, and this will be a lot more violent and a lot more recent. Of course, the conflict in the north of Ireland is very famous. Everybody knows something about the conflict in the... You ready? Good. Everybody knows something about the conflict in the north of Ireland. And generally, if we look at it from a long way away, we just think, oh, what a pity that Catholics and Protestants cannot be friends. They must be very stupid, not like us. Which, of course, is not really a very intelligent way of analysing the situation. Certainly, there are a lot of prejudices between Catholics and Protestants in Ireland and in England. I come from a Catholic family, and I would not have liked to come home to my parents with a Protestant girlfriend. That would have been bad, really, a really big problem, yes? We always make a joke, in Catholics in England, we make a joke. I came home to see my mother with a Muslim boyfriend, and she said, well, is he a Catholic Muslim or a Protestant Muslim? Yeah? This is a joke, but it's almost not a joke. Yeah, that being a Protestant is... I remember when I was a teenager, I used to read a Catholic newspaper, and there was this letter, I remember this letter from a grandmother, who says, I went into a Protestant cathedral with my little grandchild, and after a few minutes he said, Granny, can we go home now? God isn't here. Yeah. Okay, so this is the very strong prejudices. However, the conflict in Northern Ireland is not because of the prejudices. In fact, the prejudices are because of the conflict. And I'm going to try to explain today, I'm going to give you the history of Ireland in an hour and a half, but fundamentally I'm going to try to show why really we need to see this as a social conflict. And that the religion is on top of the social conflict, as is often the case. As you can see, okay, going to start then right back in history, a long way back in history, but it's necessary. I'm going to go back to the 17th century, so what, nearly 400 years ago, 350 years ago. But I'm not going to give you a lot of details of the history. 300 years ago was one of the important moments of the domination of Ireland by England. So remember the basic dates. Ireland is dependent on England until 1922, when the south of Ireland becomes independent. And the north of Ireland remains dependent on England until today. And so that's the basic situation. So why the 17th century? Well, in the 17th century, there had already been many English colonies in Ireland. In parts of Ireland, around Dublin, was occupied by the English. But there was no general colonisation of the whole of Ireland. And this happened in the 17th century, under the leadership of Oliver Cromwell. Now, you may have heard of Oliver Cromwell in your other history classes. Who was Oliver Cromwell? Well, he was the person who modernised English society in a very radical way. Let's execute the king. Let's have a republic for 11 years. Let's establish a republic or a commonwealth with no king. Extremely shocking in Europe at the time. Why? So that we can modernise the economy. We don't want the old feudal traditions. We want commerce. We want a simpler religion, a Protestant religion, with a more direct role for the individual, not so much traditional hierarchy. So certainly Oliver Cromwell organized the ordinary people in England to revolt against the old system, l'ancien régime in French. So certainly in England, certainly Cromwell destroyed many of the old traditions and made it possible for the economy to modernize, the Industrial Revolution and so on, and reduced massively the power of the king permanently. Because even today, as you know, the king is not so powerful. Even the queen is not so powerful. That's in England. In Ireland, the Irish are not very happy with Oliver Cromwell. Because part of his idea of a Protestant England, and Protestant in the 17th century meant modern, commercial, and Catholic meant like the French. Ancien régime, Louis XVIII, Versailles. Louis the something, Versailles and all the old system. Well, when he looked at Ireland, when this new English elite looked at Ireland, they said, Ireland is a problem. Why is Ireland a problem? Firstly, it's Catholic. The problem is not just the religion, it's Catholic. And so if the Spanish, the powerful Spanish Catholic kings, want to conquer England, they will begin in Ireland. And if you want to invade England, Ireland is a useful place to be. I recommend it. Yeah, if you want to invade, go to Ireland. And it was a real possibility that the Catholic Spain could find friends in Ireland to fight against England. So it was a real political danger. Voilà, j'ai vendu un écran bleu une fois, et puis après rien. Voilà, merci. So, Ireland was a political danger, firstly. Secondly, Ireland was Catholic, and the Cromwell and his friends were convinced that Protestantism was the true religion, what God really wanted for the world. And thirdly, there was the standard, the colonial attitude that we understand scientific agriculture. Look at the Irish. They are very poor. They do not use the land properly. And so they have no rights to it. In the same way, when the Europeans went to America and they saw the American Indians, they said, well, what is this? They don't have ownership of the land. They are primitive peoples. They're not even Christian. They do not deserve the land. So the land is ours. It's ours. So the colonial attitude is it's okay to take the land because their civilization is not a civilization. We are the only civilization. And so Cromwell went to Ireland convinced that he was bringing civilization. And if it was rather violent, well, that's life. And so Cromwell went to Ireland to repress a rebellion against English rule and became very well known for the attack on a particular town, Drogheda. Drogheda is a town in Ireland which resisted against Cromwell, and there was a horrible massacre. Genre, on met tous ceux qui restent en église et on brûle l'église. Vous voyez, c'est efficace, ça marche. Look at that, that's wonderful. Drogheda is the symbol of Cromwell's very violent domination, colonial domination of Ireland. After Drogheda, the next town said, OK, you win. This is quite intelligent, really. Most of the other towns did not resist. It was too much. And Cromwell really believed, we killed these people because God wanted us. We are doing the will of God, etc. A fairly standard way of dealing with the world at that time. I will show you in a moment the practical results of Cromwell's victory. That is to say that most of the land of Ireland was taken from the Irish and given to Cromwell's soldiers and to the people who gave them money for Cromwell's expedition. So it was a very standard... merci beaucoup, c'est un peu vert, mais c'est pas grave, je suis pas à faire le difficile. Vraiment. So it was a very typical colonization, like in Africa, like in India, etc. Typical, we go, the land is ours, a bit for you, some for you, and some for you. You know, it's, shared out the land. And the Catholics had less and less land. Yeah, so the land ownership for Catholics went down very, very quickly. There were also the prisoners this is 1650, yeah, 1650. We're talking all this Cromwell, 1650. At the end of... Oui, oui, non, mais je vraiment, je suis pas bien placé pour faire le difficile. Merci. At the end of the repression of the rebellion by Cromwell, the 60,000 Irish Catholics were sent to the Barbados as slaves for the sugar plantation. Did something happen? Okay. Get up earlier. Interesting case. Many of the first slaves were Irish. It was later that they went to more systematically to Africa to get slaves. Okay, so let's see if we can get some pictures on this story. Perhaps... It's a bit green today. Le vert, c'est la couleur de l'Irlande, en fait, mais je n'ai pas fait exprès. Okay. Okay, so why are you not opening? Right, okay, this is the ones we looked at last week. And just let me bring you up to date with the pictures. I do apologise for this problem. Okay, so here is a historical map of Ireland, just to give you an idea. Before Cromwell, before Cromwell, Dublin round here, the most richest part of the country. Here we have Oliver Cromwell, the picture. And this is the statue of Oliver Cromwell in front of the Houses of Parliament in London. Which is a bit of a mystery, really, because immediately after Cromwell's death, the royal family came back to power in London, or with less power, but they came back, and they dug up Cromwell and cut his head off and put it in front of the Parliament. But many years later, somebody decided that he was a good person and they should have a statue for him. Drogheda. A picture of the battle of the time. I don't know if you can see, but they are being burnt. And here is the results of Cromwell's... sorry, did you have a question? I told you it was related to...
Yes, I wanted to know what you
were talking about. Yeah, 1650. Yeah, all this. This Cromwellian settlement. Yeah, the Cromwell's victory and the Irish defeats. It's 1650, okay, to give you a general idea. So here is the result of what happened. Number one, lands reserved for the Irish. That is, all the Irish Catholics were obliged to leave this land and go over there. un petit peu comme les réserves pour les Indiens aux États-Unis, hein, very much. And Cromwell said, before the 1st of December, you must go to Connaught, that's this region, or to hell. Yeah, you choose. So, really, to empty the land of the Catholic, especially the Catholic landowners, and the only people who could stay were the people who worked for the Protestants. Number two, section two, is given as payment to the Munster garrison, that is given to the soldiers. Oh, you were good soldiers, this land is yours. It's just a standard colonial method. Number three, again, for the soldiers. Number four is interesting. Number four, 10 counties divided between the adventurers and the soldiers. Now, the adventurers ne sont pas des aventuriers, ce sont les financiers. The people in London who gave them money for the expedition. In fact, the adventurers are very important because what did the English soldiers do with the land they received? They sold it immediately, of course. They were not farmers. They didn't want to live in Ireland. They sold it immediately. So the result was that merchants in London owned most of Ireland after 1650. So again, all the rest is similar things. Some for the soldiers, some for the financiers, and a little piece for the Irish. You will not be surprised to hear that number one is the lowest quality farmland. It's not the good land, it's the bad land. It's the land that nobody wants. Okay, so that was the first really big tragedy for the Irish people, and even today they haven't forgotten it. Now they were not eliminated like many of the Native Americans were, but their life was getting pretty hard. So back in England, the king. Charles I and then King James I, they have kings again after Cromwell, but the Parliament has more and more power. The Parliament is much more powerful now, and the power of the king is going down and down, very slowly, but it's going down and down. And the final episode in that conflict is in 1688, what we sometimes call the Glorious Revolution. Même s'il y a un historien qui a dit que c'était ni une révolution ni glorieuse. Yeah. And the Glorious Revolution is very simple. The Parliament was unhappy with a Catholic king, and so they sacked the Catholic king and chose another king, a Protestant king. So it was very clear that Parliament was the boss. Yeah. If they were unhappy, they changed the king. It's not a traditional way of dealing with kings. And so, after 1688, there will never again be a Catholic king. The last Catholic king of England. And the last Catholic king of England was replaced by William of Orange. King William was the Protestant who replaced the Catholic king. And they wrote in the law, the king cannot be a Catholic. Never again. Also, the king cannot marry a Catholic, and the queen cannot marry a Catholic. Now, this is a fascinating story, because much later, they changed the law and said, okay, the situation today is the king cannot be a Catholic, and the queen cannot be a Catholic, but the king or queen can marry a Catholic. And what is amusing about this is that this new law was changed on the 24th of October, 2011. Last week. They changed this law last week. So now it is possible for the king or the queen to marry a Catholic. I'm very disappointed because I think I'm too old. But, you know, it would have been nice, yeah? But I thought that was very... Ils sont pas rapides, les Anglais. Ils attendent. Allez, 350 ans, on y arrive. Okay, so... But this becomes... as you can see, the conflict between Protestants and Catholics is the conflict between the English and the Irish. After this, you have more and more Protestants who come in, but they will always be privileged compared with the Catholics. And the next big episode is another attempt at rebellion by the Irish. They go and find the Catholic king who has been sacked, James, and they bring him to Ireland and they rebel against William. And William comes to Ireland. And there is the Battle of the Boyne in 1690. And this is the defeat for James, victory for William, the final victory of Protestants against Catholics in the realm of the monarchy of Britain. We will never again have a Catholic king. This is the last chance. And they lost. And here is a celebration of the Battle of the Boyne. Every year, today, every year in the north of Ireland, there are marches of Protestants to say, the Battle of the Boyne was wonderful. We won against the Catholics. These marches are complicated, but fundamentally they are racist marches against the Catholics. We will see more of this in a moment. Imaginez si la droite en France organisait tous les ans une commémoration des croisades à Barbès. Yeah, it's a bit like that. It's a bit like that. When they go over the bridge near the Catholic houses, they throw coins, they throw money. They are not throwing money to be generous. Yes, it is a sign of what's the word in English? Mépris, disdain. Yeah, they throw money to the Catholics. And this is the big, the Orange Order. I will come back to the Orange Order in a moment. But what is interesting is that even today, the Battle of the Boyne is a big celebration for a section of the Protestant community every year. On the 12th of July, a big celebration, and sometimes a cause for a big conflict. So it's a very old battle, but it's become a symbol of Protestant superiority over Catholics. After the Battle of the Boyne in 1690, we see the. Enfin, non, ça c'est simplement pour résumer comment les propriétaires terriens sont devenus tous protestants. Enfin, à cette période, ce que j'ai déjà dit, alors je le laisse. After 1690, the Battle of the Boyne, for a period, life was very difficult for Catholics. If you were Catholic, you were not allowed to vote. You were not allowed to become a member of Parliament. Now, remember, at this period, only rich people could vote. But in fact, only rich Protestants could vote, and rich Catholics could not vote. So a very strong situation for 150 years. For 150 years, Catholics could not become a lawyer, could not become a judge. And so the justice system was completely controlled by the Protestants. And it was impossible to have a fair trial if you were a Catholic. I'm not going to go through the whole history of Ireland, so let's jump 100 years. To 1798. 1798 is the rebellion. 1798. I know that numbers are sometimes difficult. In 1798, there is a rebellion organized by the United Irishmen. Most of the United Irishmen are Catholics. But not all. There are some Protestants as well. And the United Irishmen want independence for Ireland. Their leader is Wolfe Tone. That's a nice name, isn't it? Che Guevara, Wolfe Tone. This is a little bit of one of his speeches. To subvert the tyranny of our execrable governments, to break the connection with England, the never-failing source of all our political evils, and to assert the independence of my country, these were my objectives. Okay, so aiming at independence of Ireland, which of course today is still not the case, yeah, because Ireland is divided between an independent section and another independent section. To unite the whole people of Ireland, to abolish the memory of all past dissensions, and to substitute the common name of Irishman in place of the denominations of Protestant, Catholic, and Dissenter. These were my means. So Wolfe Tone is saying, we need to forget the difference between Catholics and Protestants and Dissenters from the Protestant people. The only important thing is to be Irish. And then underneath, another quotation from Wolfe Tone, our freedom must be had at all hazards. If the men of property will not help us, they must fall. We will free ourselves by the aid of that large and respectable class of the community, the men of no property. So really, we can see that Wolfe Tone is a little bit like Oliver Cromwell. He's a little bit like Robespierre in France. He realised that if you want to win against the powerful, it's necessary to mobilise all the people. So that's very, very typical of Robespierre or Cromwell. He realised it was not possible to only mobilise the elites. It was necessary to mobilise all of the people. And this is in a period where democracy, there is no democracy. Democracy is not very popular, in fact. Here he is, Wolfe Tone. It's a statue. It's not really him. A statue to Wolfe Tone, a leading figure in the 1798 rebellion. If you go to Ireland, you will see statues of Wolfe Tone a little bit everywhere. Yeah, it's a very important symbol today, a leading figure in the 1798 rebellion. This statue is in Dublin. Of course, as you can imagine, the 1798 rebellion was not successful. It was repressed, and there will be several more rebellions of the Irish. After the defeats of the United Irishmen in 1798, the Act of Union was passed. That is to say that Ireland was joined to the United Kingdom. So after 1800, the official name of the country was the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland. And today, the official name of the country is the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. Okay, so it would be very, very important. And the Act of Union was, of course, not very popular in Ireland. And there were a series of protests, campaigns, etc., up and down for the next 50 years. One of the victories was in 1829. In 1829, after a very long campaign of protests and meetings, it was successfully established Catholic emancipation. What does Catholic emancipation mean? It simply means that Catholics have the same rights as Protestants to stand in parliaments, to become a lawyer or a doctor, etc. Okay, so 1829, after 150 years, Catholic emancipation was possible. This is just before the arrival of Queen Victoria on the throne. So, of course, we are in a much more modern society. The Industrial Revolution is happening. The Industrial Revolution in Ireland is dominated by English money. And so what you have is, in the north, Belfast, Derry, industry. Big industry. C'est peut-être pas le meilleur des exemples, mais le Titanic a été construit à Belfast. It's not the best example because it was not very successful, but it was big. Yeah, they had some of the biggest shipyards in the world in Belfast. So industry was in Dublin, Belfast and Derry, and the rest of the country remained agricultural and very poor. There was no money to do this. Catholic emancipation was the campaign for Catholic emancipation was led by Daniel O'Connell. D'ailleurs, la plus grande rue de Dublin, c'est O'Connell Street. So he's a famous guy, yeah? Il est moins vert que ça d'habitude, mais bon. A statue of Daniel O'Connell, nicknamed the Liberator by his supporters. But what is interesting about this statue is it is in Melbourne in Australia. And this is a symbol because, of course, one of the key experiences of Irish people is leaving Ireland. And there is a massive, what we call a diaspora. Millions of Irish people left Ireland because it was too poor. And for more reasons I will tell you in a moment. My great-grandparents left Ireland and came to Liverpool to work on the railway. And millions of other Irish people did. We sometimes say today there are more Irish people in New York than in the whole of Ireland. This may or may not be true, but certainly there are a lot of Irish people everywhere, but especially Liverpool, New York, Melbourne, Australia. So the fact that you have a statue, it's an interesting example, is that the Irish arrive, they have a big community, they maintain the Irish identity, Catholic cathedral, and a statue of Daniel O'Connell, the nationalist leader. It's an interesting way of maintaining your identity. Okay, the rebellion and the Catholic emancipation. We're still in the 19th century. I apologize for going back into history, except that if you look at Northern Ireland today, if you don't know the history, you understand nothing. And the majority of journalists who write about Northern Ireland, it's not even worth reading the article, because if you don't know the history, it's a waste of time. Yeah. I don't know what it's like. It's like something. Okay. Let's go. So one of the... I want to look at another of the founding myths. Les mythes fondateurs. Now, be careful with the expression founding myths. It does not mean stories which are not true. It means stories which are more important than their truth. So, for example, the Irish Rebellion of 1798 is a founding myth. All of the Irish are, yes, the Great Rebellion of 1798 against the English. And probably they exaggerate and simplify, because exaggerating and simplifying is what you do with a founding myth. And I want now, so the 1798 Rebellion is one founding myth. Let me look at another founding myth, which is a little bit depressing, I'm afraid. But one of the problems is most of history is actually pretty depressing. So, yeah, that's life. And this is the Great Hunger. The Great Hunger. In the middle of the 19th century, Ireland produced expensive food, corn and cows and sheep, to send to England. But it was too expensive for most of the Irish. The Irish ate potatoes. And really, really potatoes in the morning and in the afternoon, yeah? Maybe some meat on Sundays, yeah? It was really very, very, very poor, a potato-based diet. And in 1845, there was a terrible potato disease. Maladie de pomme de terre. Okay. Now, normal, in a normal country, this is not such a big problem. Oh, no potatoes, let's eat bread. But the poor people in Ireland had only potatoes to eat, and millions of people were terribly affected. Fundamentally, a million people died, and a million people left Ireland. So I simplify, but yet with a massive change. It transformed Ireland forever. And one of the reasons it is a founding myth is that during the famine, Ireland continued to export food to England. And that the English sent the army to protect the ships which were exporting food. A lot of the English elites really believed the Irish, they are so primitive, it doesn't really matter if a million of them die. It's not really very important. It's a very traditional view. It's important not to look with today's ideas. Yeah, they really considered the Irish to be completely inferior, and therefore not such a big problem. So this terrible situation. There are horrible descriptions of it, of families closing their door and locking the door and blocking the door so that they could die together with their family. And terrible things of people eating the trees or eating anything they could. Cannibalism in some regions. It's not a happy story. Okay. Here is, in Dublin, a memorial to the Great Famine of the 1850s. There are two or three interesting things about that. You can see it's quite depressing, yes. Quite depressing situation. They are statues, they're not real people. Look at the dog. It's lucky that there's a dog, because of course people ate their dogs and cats, of course. What's interesting about it is obviously quite a modern statue. This is, I don't know when, but 1960s, 1970s. It's not a 1900 statue. The style is too modern. Il y a pas de piédestal déjà. Il y a pas de piédestal. Avant 1960, je pense qu'il y a pas de statue publique sans piédestal. Okay, so that's the memorial in Dublin, and it's very moving to go to it, because like, my great grandparents left Ireland because of the famine. They were lucky; they didn't die, and so I found it very, very impressive. And around the world, there are other similar monuments. This one is in Boston, Massachusetts. Boston, Massachusetts. Lots of Irish people went there. This is a rather special monument here. You can see here is Ireland and the hungry people. Quoique dans la ménagerie américaine, même les affamés ne sont pas tout à fait très minces, finalement. Ils n'arrivent pas à les imaginer plus minces que ça. And these are the Irish people who have left Ireland and come to America, and they are happy and full of health, etc. Which was generally true. Although when the Irish arrived in New York, life was hard. When I went to New York, I saw a pub on 6th Avenue. I've only been once. And it was called Mullen's Pub. That's my name. And it's a very rare name. It's a very unusual name. And so I went into the pub and I said, well, my name's Mullen too. And he said, where did your family come from, the north or the south? And I said, the north. He said, ah, sheep stealers. So, you're des voleurs de moutons, quoi. Bon. So now I know. Okay. Right, okay. Well, you've been listening very carefully, so let's have a look. This is a poem written at the time by one of the nationalists, Jane Francesca Agnes. Ne le recopiez pas, hein. Je vais de toute façon mettre les diapos de mon blog à un moment. Weary men, what reap ye? Golden corn for the stranger. What sow ye? Human corpses that wait for the avenger. Fainting forms, hunger stricken. What see you in the offing? Stately ships to bear our food away amid the stranger's scuffing. Okay, alors les hommes fatigués, qu'est-ce que vous récoltez du blé doré pour l'étranger? Et qu'est-ce que vous semez? Nous semons des cadavres qui attendent la vengeance. Okay, so you can see that the hunger is not seen as a tragedy, but as a crime by the English. Okay, now, it's partly a matter of political opinion, yeah? But it's certainly that if you go to Dublin and you ask 100 Irish people about it, everybody agrees it's a founding myth. There is no debate in Ireland. People agree on this view of it. Stately ships to bear our food away. Des navires élégants qui emportent notre nourriture pendant que l'étranger se moque. Okay, so you can see a very emotional view of the situation. There's a proud array of soldiers. What do they round your door? They guard our master's granary from the thin hands of the poor. Pale mothers, wherefore weeping? Would to God that we were dead. Our children swoon before us, and we cannot give them bread. Nous prions à Dieu que de mourir, parce que nos enfants s'évanouissent devant nous et nous n'avons pas de pain à leur donner. I told you it was depressing. Okay. Another famine memorial in Toronto. Yes, around the world, 1 million Irishmen left Ireland. And they went somewhere, anywhere. First they went to England, because it's not far, and then anywhere, doing any work. Refugees. A famine memorial in Toronto then. Because you've been listening very, very carefully and very nobly, I think we could have a little song here. And I have a song, very, very famous song, about the famine. En théorie. Yeah, you remember I always have some difficulty with this, don't I? Well, that's in. Okay. And then what about the other one?
Our love was on the way.
my mother hates this song. Okay. Now, this is what is important about this song. It is extremely... it is extremely popular. The Irish football crowd sing this song. It become the symbol. You can see what's happened. Yes, this is a young woman singing because her boyfriend has been imprisoned because he was stealing food to feed their child. So very classic Irish laments. Okay. Now, of course, when the Irish arrive in England or America, they have a lot of choices about identity. And I will be looking at this in a couple of weeks' time when I will be looking at Irish immigrants in Britain. But the famine is one of these big events. The following 50 years, you have a couple of rebellions, but in particular, at the end of the 19th century, you have a big campaign for home rule. Huge campaign for home rule. The main political parties in England, the Conservatives, or the Tories, the Conservatives and the Liberals, are terribly divided on the question of home rule for Ireland. Just in the same way as I mentioned last week, home rule is not independence. Home rule is autonomy, a separate parliament, some autonomy, but not independence. So you have some people who say, we must have home rule because this will stop the people who want independence from getting independence. And you have other people who say, we must have home rule because it's the first step to independence. So you have a strange alliance for home rule, extremely powerful. In the north of Ireland, a large section of the Protestant population campaign against home rule under the slogan "Home rule is Rome rule." If we have autonomy, we will be dominated by the Catholics from Rome. Home rule is Rome. Rome rule is the slogan of the Protestant opponents of home rule. At this time, the Protestants are organised as a privileged section of the population in the north. For example, many of the shipyards, the best jobs, not wonderful jobs, but the better jobs, they will only employ Protestants. And for 100 years, even today, if you are a Catholic in Northern Ireland, it's not so easy to get a job. For 100 years, are you a Catholic or a Protestant before you can get a job? Today, it's illegal to say, are you a Catholic or a Protestant? So they say, what school did you go to? The school of the Virgin Mary. Okay, yeah. The discrimination continues, but it was much worse 100 years ago. And the Protestants organised the Orange Order, not all the Protestants, of course, just a section. There's nothing. They organised this special organisation, the Orange Order. And this is what they wear, the sash. And it's in orange. And this is in 1890, when they celebrated 200 years after the Battle of the Boyne. It's a popular organisation. And it organises culture, sports, and a whole load of things to say, we are British and we are better than the Catholics. The Orange Order also, if you wanted a job and you're a Protestant, you go to the Orange Order. And the Orange Order bosses will give jobs to Orange Order workers. Okay, so it's a form of caste system based around religion. And on the other side, on the Catholic side, there were organisations like the Gaelic League, who tried to organise the Irish language against the English language, Irish sports, Irish culture, etc. But of course, the Gaelic League was organised among Catholics who didn't have the same power. During all of this period, the emigration continues, and I will come back to that in a moment. But first of all, some events from the beginning of the 20th century.
Vous voyez, je suis enfin arrivé au 20e siècle, je savais que ça allait venir.
In 1907, an enormous strike, une grève, yeah, an enormous strike in Belfast. And what was very special about this big strike is there were Catholic and Protestant workers together, all on strike. And this was led by Jim Larkin. There was a statue of him in Dublin. An interesting statue because very often, if you lead a big strike, nobody makes a statue of you. If you're a king, you get a statue. Prime ministers, you get a statue. If you lead a big strike, you don't normally get a statue. But in the south of Ireland, the government of the south of Ireland feels close to the tradition of Irish nationalism, and this included trade unions. So Jim Larkin was famous for uniting the Catholic and Protestant workers in a big dockers strike in June 1907. Even towards the end of the strike, the police joined the strike. And I already explained to you a few weeks ago, when the police are on strike, the government is very worried. It's not easy to organise the police to go on strike. They don't like it. But when they feel obliged to strike, they are tremendously annoyed, the elites. Between 1910 and 1914, there is a wave of strikes, a lot of strikes. And the crisis about home rule becomes extremely powerful. A section of the Protestants say, if there is home rule, we will organise a military insurrection. Yeah. So it's no longer just a question of protests, government laws, etc. In 1913, we have the formation of a military organisation, the Ulster Volunteer Force. And the Ulster Volunteer Force say, if in London they pass a law for home rule, we will fight. The Ulster Volunteer Force, then a Protestant organisation, who find money for guns, and they are paramilitary organisation. And in response, the Irish Citizen Army. The Irish Citizen Army organises a paramilitary organisation to fight for home rule. So you can see that just before the First World War, we're in a situation where there is a real danger of civil war. There is a real danger of civil war. The Ulster Volunteer Force organised a small rebellion, and the British London, they send the British Army, and the British Army refused to fight against the Protestants. This is in 1914. A mutiny. The British Army officers say, "Oh, we are not fighting Protestants. They are the same. They are our people." So, in fact, what is happening is that the English officers, the elite of the British Army, they are not neutral between these two. They consider that the Protestants who defend Great Britain and the Empire are the goodies, and the Catholic the Catholics who want independence are the baddies. Just a little point about vocabulary. You have groups, this is a paramilitary group, but in general you have political groups who want to be close to England. They are mostly, almost all Protestants, and we call them unionists or loyalists. Unionist, dans un autre contexte, veut dire syndicaliste. Ici veut dire pour l'union avec l'Angleterre. Yeah, unionists or loyalists, mostly Protestants. On the other side, you have nationalists. The nationalists who are Irish nationalists. Many of them are Republicans. And most of them, but not all of them, are Catholics. So you have sort of mostly Catholics, Republicans and nationalists, and loyalists and unionists. These are all the vocabulary we use for this side. Okay. During this period, of course, the emigration continues. And I wanted to play you another song. This is an extremely popular song called Danny Boy. And it's sung, apparently, by a father whose son is leaving. His son is leaving Ireland, probably to go to America. I hope you will come back, but you know, it's not so easy to come back. It's a long way. And here we have the words. Yeah, oh daddy boy, the pipes are calling from glen to glen and down the mountainside. The summer's gone and all the flowers are dying. Tis you must go and I must bide. Je dois rester. Tu dois partir, je dois rester. But come you back, si tu reviens. But come you back when summer's in the meadow or when the valley's hushed and white with snow. Tis I'll be here in sunshine or in shadow. Oh Danny boy, I love you so. Now, there are a few interesting things about this. First of all, it's quite melodramatic. In the second verse, it's, when you come back, if I am already dead, and I probably already will be dead, say a prayer for me, and I will feel more comfortable in my grave. It's very, very melodramatic. But there's something else which is interesting. This is a song of a father to his son, and it ends, I love you so. This is in 1900. It is almost impossible to find an English song with an English father singing I love you so to his son in 1900. Men did not express their emotions in this way. But it was possible for the Irish, who were considered inferior. They were allowed to sing more. Yeah? The only other songs in 1900 of men saying positive things about their children are songs which are sung by white people disguised as black people for the same reason. Expressing emotion is for inferior sorts of men. Yeah, that's how it works there. Let's have a listen to this one because this is kind of, again, extremely famous.
The pipes are calling from glen to glen and down the mountainside. The summer's gone.
Is I'll be
Okay, so there are a million more songs of Irish people about their children leaving Ireland. It's the favourite theme. This is what we like to have songs about. And certainly, Danny Boy, if you ever want to make any Irish person cry, you just play them that or sing them that, and it will work. So arrives, of course, the big trauma, the First World War. The First World War in 1914. Most of the Protestants support the First World War, of course. It's the British Empire. They want to be part of the British Empire. They want to prove that they are loyal to the Empire so that they will remain important to London. The nationalist organisations, the Irish nationalist organisations, are divided. One section says, if we fight for England, England will give us home rule afterwards as a reward. Another section says, no, now is the time. England is busy. The English army is in France, in Turkey. Now is the time to revolt. The enemy is weak. The English enemy is weak. So we can revolt now. We can win independence. It's the perfect time because the enemy, England, is at war with Germany. So you have a massive debate. Il y a nombre de journaux publiés par mètre carré en Irlande à cette époque. You know, big debates, okay? No unity, completely divided, the Catholics completely divided, the Protestants completely divided on political terms. In Turkey and in France, many Irish people are killed along with the English and the French. And there are more famous songs about, you know, why did you die for England when your land is not free, etc. A lot of songs. It has to be said that music is extremely important to Irish culture. If you go to Dublin, I won't say there is music in every pub, but there is really a lot of music around, and it's not just for the tourists. It's all year round. Yeah, it's a really extremely powerful tradition. So those parts of the nationalist movement who thought that now was the right time to revolt, organise a revolt. They organised a revolt in 1916. The Easter Rising, le soulèvement de Pâques, parce que c'était le lundi de Pâques. It's not an accident that they chose Easter. It's an important date for Catholics. It's not an accident. But in history, nothing is an accident, anyway. The leaders of the uprising are mostly Catholic nationalist poets and intellectuals. This is often the case. Anti-colonial resistance movements are often led by intellectuals, poets, and so on. You know, this is in Africa and elsewhere. These are people who have a little bit more independence. And they have a rising. They occupy the post office. The post office is very important at the time. All the telephone and the telegraph, blah, 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 blah. All the information goes through the post office. No television, very little radio. So it's not an accident they occupy the post offices. It's not to steal the stamps. Yeah, that's right. So the post office, etc. About 2,000, 3,000 nationalists. It lasts for a few days. The British army arrives and it is defeated. The fundamental problem for the nationalists is that they hoped that all of the other towns would follow, and they didn't follow. That's sad. There you go. But symbolically, extremely important. In front of the post office, they read the proclamation of the Irish Republic. They declare, Ireland is now a republic, and we are the provisional government. The rising is defeated. all the leaders are executed a few days later. It's only a few days later. It is dangerous for the English government to have a long trial. They are immediately executed. And so that's not so good for them. However, the reaction after their execution will probably lead to the independence of the south of Ireland. They become heroes after their execution. They become an important symbol. And here they are. Oh, well, here's the James Connolly. James Connolly again. James Connolly was a trade unionist. He worked organising workers. And here is his slogan: the cause of labour is the cause of Ireland. The cause of Ireland is the cause of labour. La cause des travailleurs, c'est la cause de l'Irlande, et vice versa. Okay, so there is James Connolly. Again, in Dublin. He was one of the leaders of the insurrection. Another one, Michael Collins, poet. And here is a picture of the actual rising. The British army arrive with a ship, and they bomb the centre of Dublin. It's all kind of destroyed, really, afterwards. What is interesting with this, this is a postcard sold in England to say, oh, look what's happening in Ireland. Remember, no radio, no television, so postcards are important. And it says here, the Sinn Féin revolt in Dublin. Sinn Féin is a political party established in Ireland in 1905. They did not take any part in the insurrection. They were more sort of moderate parliamentarians, but they were blamed for the insurrection. So all the media said, it was Sinn Féin did it, but in fact Sinn Féin were against it at the time. Okay, so Patrick Pearce, yes, did I say Patrick Pearce? J'ai supprimé Patrick Pearce. Another of the leaders was another poet, Patrick Pearce, who had organised for many years to defend the Irish language. Because in all this period, there are a series of campaigns to defend Irish language, Irish culture, against the imposition of English. Sinn Féin rebellion again. Alors vous voyez, donc ça, encore une carte postale, avant et après. And here is the Declaration of the Irish Republic. This is what they read in front of the post office in 1916. There are still five copies left. One of them is in the museum in Dublin. And it's very interesting what they say. They were all poets. It's very poetic. It's about the historic destiny of Ireland. And very, very important, it says, Catholics and Protestants must be equal. Very, very important at the time. Yeah. So most of the rebellion were Catholics, but they were very aware that it was necessary to go further. In the elections in 1918, Sinn Féin, the moderate nationalists, if you like, the ones who were against the insurrection, were extremely successful. The nationalist votes rose very quickly. And here you can see in 1918 the poster that they used, the slogan they used: if you really want an Irish Republic, vote for Sinn Féin. So what they're saying, if you really want an Irish Republic, don't organise an insurrection because they lost. We have the real solution. So it's a very political poster. If you really want an Irish Republic, vote for Sinn Féin. In the election of 1918, Sinn Féin got 73 members, and the Unionists, donc ceux qui étaient pour l'Union avec la Grande-Bretagne, 25. 73 to 25. So an easy majority for the nationalists who wanted independence for Ireland and the Republic. However, of course, these 100 members of Parliament, where did they go? They go to London to sit in the same Parliament with 500 members from England and Scotland who do not want independence. And so here you have a political, a very difficult political situation. You have 100 members of Parliament from Ireland. 75 of them are in favour of an independent republic. But they cannot establish a republic by parliamentary means because they are in London in a big parliament with lots of English members of Parliament who do not want Ireland to be independent. The result is a war between England and Ireland. In 1919, the Anglo-Irish War begins. The 100 members of Parliament sit in Dublin and they say, no, we are now an independent parliament. Yeah. And they declare the independence of Ireland. There is a war between England and Ireland, the Anglo-Irish War. My great-grandfather, fought in the English Anglo-Irish War in the English Army. I'm a little bit sad about that, but they, what can you do? It was just a job, I guess. And the result was in 1921, a treaty. So the Anglo-Irish War was very violent. It was partly a civil war because a lot of the Irish supported the English army, especially Protestants in the north. So it was not pretty. Yeah? Torture, the normal things you get in civil wars. There is a recent film by Ken Loach, Le Vent se lève, about this Anglo-Irish War. It's very interesting, but pretty violent. Yeah? I went to see the film and my wife left halfway through the film. Yeah, it's pretty violent and horrible. But there you go. You can close your eyes. I did. So the 1921 Anglo-Irish Treaty, which was a compromise. It was a compromise, and the compromise said, let's divide Ireland into two. The south, which is mostly Catholic, can be independent. The north, which is mostly Protestant and has the best industry, will stay with England. And this is partition, the dividing of Ireland, and it is still the case today. It is still the case today. Now, it has a number of political problems. The first thing is that the line was drawn very artificially. It's not a historic region. It's just, where is the Protestant majority? Ah, there they are. Okay. That's the first thing. And the second thing is that the two biggest industrial towns where all the money was, Derry and Belfast, remain close to England. In the south of Ireland, people are divided. Some people say, well, I would like independence for the whole of Ireland, but the British army is too powerful, so let's accept. Other people say, no, we must continue the war. And even today, there are people who think that the war should be continued. So there is an independent state in the south, qui fait encore partie du Commonwealth britannique à cette époque, ne va pas être une république tout de suite, ça va devenir république dans les années 30. And that's the situation of partition. Again, I'm going to jump forward to the Second World War. And after the Second World War, during the Second World War, Ireland, the south of Ireland, remains neutral. Because they say, the government of the south of Ireland says, we cannot fight side by side with England, because England is occupying a part of our country. It's not possible. So they remain independent and neutral during the Second World War. For at one moment, Winston Churchill says, we must invade Ireland, because, of course, Ireland is... It's dangerous to have a neutral island just next to you in a big war. But they decide, if we invade Ireland, we must fight against the Irish as well. Well, that's not so easy. And so that continues. So let's move on to after the Second World War, the 1960s. Life, of course, is getting better in Ireland. The economy is in better states. Some of the progress in all the economies continues in Ireland. But in Northern Ireland, parce que maintenant je me concentre seulement sur le nord de l'Irlande, in Northern Ireland, the tensions are very high. Protestants have much better working conditions and living conditions than Catholics, and racism against Catholics is very strong. For example, the police. The Protestants are 60% of the population and 95% of the police. That's just a symbol. The Catholics do not trust the police at all. And in fact, the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, will become the police force in the Catholic parts of town. Because that's the way it works. In the 1960s, the IRA is not very j'avais une petite anecdote. There's also the religious problem, which continues. In the 1950s, one of the extremist Protestant leaders, he meets a Catholic girl who is 15 years old, and he persuades her that Protestantism is better. She converts. She was a Catholic. She becomes a Protestant, and this man goes to the tribunal and says, "We must take her away from her family. She's a Protestant now. She cannot stay with a Catholic family because it's not safe for her." And the tribunal, which of course is Protestant, says, "Yes, okay, you can take her away from her family because she has changed her religion to Protestantism." That's just one example. You can see that very, very high level of tension in a situation where the Protestants consider that the Catholics are inferior. There is fighting in the north between Protestants and Catholics, and in 1969, the British government sends the British Army. Now, at the beginning, when the British Army arrives, the Catholics in the Catholic parts of Belfast say, "It's good." Because life, they were in great danger from the Protestant paramilitaries and from the Protestant police. And they imagine that the British Army will be more neutral. This is the case for 6 months or so. But afterwards, the British Army is very clearly allied with the Protestant police, and they are not neutral. In fact, there is nobody thinks that the British Army was neutral in Northern Ireland. I mean, nobody serious thinks this anymore. Now, before the arrival of the army, the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, a paramilitary organisation, was very, very weak in the 1960s. They didn't manage to find a new generation of militants. When the British Army arrived and there was a lot of fighting, the IRA got more and more people involved. Let's have a look at some of the motions. We're now in the 1960s. In the 1960s, the British Army established with the British government a policy of internment. Internment means you can put people in prison without a trial. A trial is not necessary. So, in fact, what happens is the police come and say, "I think he's a member of the IRA." And so he is in prison for many years, but there's no trial. There's no need for a trial. Yeah, so it says, comme un état d'urgence. So internment without trial was very, very hard for the Catholic populations. Most of the young men were in prison. Yes? Yes, have I got an exact idea? In fact, internment begins. It begins in 1956. Mais en fait, c'est pas très clair ça, parce que ça commence en 56, mais en réalité, c'est 10 ans plus tard que ça s'accélère beaucoup. Donc, c'est pas tellement l'introduction. So, in the 1960s, especially in 1970, 1971, there is a very heavy situation. And the Catholic parts of town don't want the British army and the British police to come in. And here is a famous mural: you are now entering Free Derry. That is, in this part of town, the British army and the British police cannot come in. So a very strong symbol, you can imagine. So it's not exactly a civil war, but it's very close. Yeah, if you have a community announcing the police and the army must stop here, yeah, it's a very, very strong situation of conflict. So this has become very famous. And the Irish Catholics considered themselves in a similar situation as the Vietnamese fighting against the Americans, the American blacks fighting for civil rights. They saw it as part of the same movement. And the next big, big moment is 1972. And in 1972, you have the events of Bloody Sunday, which transformed the situation for 30 years. There was a demonstration in January 1972 for civil rights, for equal rights for Catholics. It was, and the army said, we think there are people from the IRA in this demonstration. There are 13 men are killed. 13 Catholics are killed. Now, they are killed in a very specific situation. They live in one of the poorer parts of town, like Crete, yeah? And they are killed in front of their houses, in front of their estate. 5,000 people watching. There are 5,000 Catholics watching, and the 13 men are shot in the back. They don't have any arms. They're shot in the back and just executed by the army in front of the house. And everybody knows, everybody saw it. And the next day in the newspapers it said the army was obliged to defend itself, etc. So, terribly, terribly emotional situation. And the political situation transformed. Because before Bloody Sunday, you have a big argument. I support the IRA because violence is the only possibility. No, we must have demonstrations and politics and political debates. After Bloody Sunday, the IRA recruited 1,000 people in a week. Because the people who said violence is not necessary, you're stupid. They just appeared to be stupid. Because they watched the young people executed in front of their houses with no arms. And so it was just a thing. Now, the interesting thing is that in 1972, the story I just told you, in 1972, this was a story being told only by the Irish nationalists. Today, it is the official report of the British government which says they were shot in the back, they had no arms, the army was not in danger. That today, 30 years later, this is the official, it's Lord, see, Lord, immediately after Bloody Sunday, there was an inquiry. It lasted a week, and they said the army was obliged to defend themselves. In the House of Commons in London, they voted, yes, the army was obliged to defend itself. And the House of Lords also. And very bizarrely, 20 years later, or 25 years later, there was a new inquiry. Alors, en principe, c'était contre la loi, parce que quand on a voté une enquête parlementaire et c'est fermé, on n'a pas le droit d'en ouvrir un autre. Mais ils ont été obligés, parce que c'était trop gros. Et aujourd'hui, bon, c'est un peu tard, mais aujourd'hui, il est possible que certains des soldats soient poursuivis pour meurtre. Okay, so here are the reactions after that. Here is the one of the campaigns for independence for Ireland. It's a stamp, and you can see the stamp puts a cross on the head of the Queen and says, fight for United Ireland. United Ireland, yes. So it's a special campaign of stamping your stamps before you use them. And here is a mural of the people who were killed on Bloody Sunday. Those are the people who were killed on Bloody Sunday. The mural has became an important method of communication in Northern Ireland, not communication, of symbolic representation of politics. It's an interesting idea. If you're going to do a political mural, you need the support of people who live around, because otherwise they will take it off. Yeah? So it's a community method of communication. There you get, that's Bloody Sunday, a mural. Here's the army, civil rights. And here is a true picture from the events of Bloody Sunday. This is one of the priests involved. The film. Recent film, yes, of course, it was possible to do a film like this 30 years later. Yeah. If you made this film in 1972, no television or cinema would show it. But 30 years later, it's possible. This is written at the time. This is Eamon McCann, what happened in Derry. This was written in 1972. Thanks on Team Secretary. The murals were not, there are not only Catholic murals to defend the independence of Ireland and to oppose the British Army. There are also Unionist, Loyalist murals. This is the East Belfast Brigade of the Ulster Freedom Fighters, which is a Protestant organisation, a paramilitary organisation like the IRA. Yeah, they have guns. And they use the symbol of the Red Hand. And here are the fighters, the East Belfast Brigade. In Belfast at the time, it was very much segregated. If you were a Catholic, you didn't go into this part of town. Yeah? Or you came out dead. Yeah? It was very, very, very hard segregation. And here is the slogan, for as long as 100 of us remain alive, we shall never in any way consent to submit to the Irish. For it's not for glory, honour or riches we fight, but for freedom alone, which no man loses but with his life. Now, the Ulster Freedom Fighters. And there's another one, the Ulster Volunteer Force. For God and who? Ulster. For God and Ulster. Yeah. Ulster is the name which is very often used by the Loyalist for Northern Ireland, Ulster. It's a historic region, which is bigger, in fact. Okay, so you can see these murals really are symbols of a strong community support for paramilitary organisations. The paramilitary organisations, the IRA, or the Catholic Nationalists, and the UVF for the supporters of the British Empire and mostly being Protestants. But both of them had a lot of community support. Both of the organisations. They had a lot of people supporting them. This is probably why the reaction of the British government to say, oh, well, they are just criminals, we will treat them like criminals, it was not possible. They had too much support. And eventually what turned out was it was impossible for the IRA to defeat the British Army, of course. The British Army is big. But it was also impossible for the British Army to defeat the IRA. And they got this sort of stalemate situation. During this period, of course, this is the period that we call the Troubles, les Irlandais, les Troubles, pour dire, cette guerre civile larvée qui a duré 30 ans. What was it like? Well, there were attacks on both sides. It was not really a civil war, but every year there would be 50, 60, 100 people killed. So it was quite big, you know, it was important, but it was not a battle every day. The military action on the two sides was rather different. The IRA attacked the police and the army, whereas the UVF attacked any Catholic. It was not the same thing. But sometimes, of course, it was very, very, very high level of tension. For example, at different times, the IRA, in 1974, the IRA in Britain, they exploded a pub. It was a pub with British soldiers in it, and they killed a lot of people, not all of them soldiers. And this was, you may have heard this story, five or six Irishmen were immediately arrested, and after 17 years in prison, they were declared innocent. In fact, the pressure was so big on the police that they took any young Irish man and they hit him until he signed a piece of paper, and then he was found guilty. In fact, it was quite funny, really, because they arrested these people, and really they were young, petty criminals, pickpockets, drunks, hooligans, little hooligans, which was absolutely ridiculous, because the IRA was a very serious military organisation. They did not recruit hooligans at all, and so nobody should have believed it, but everybody believed it, and When the second trial came around, it turned out that the police had invented the story. You can see this again in a film, the film In the Name of the Father, Au Nom du Père. Again, not a little depressing, but what can you do? Less depressing at the time is in the 70s and 80s, just as there was a revival of Welsh and Scottish nationalism, there was a revival of Irish popular music. And in particular, Irish folk music became very popular in England and internationally, and also in Ireland at this period. And here are one of the most famous groups, which is the Chieftains. And I'll just try a little bit of music by the Chieftains. Okay, it's a particular form of folk music. It's still quite alive. If you're lucky and you go to Dublin, you can go. They do a little presentation of Irish folk music, and it's very impressive because he takes the violin and he says, "This is how you play the violin in the west of Ireland, and this is how you play it in the southeast." Completely different local traditions of how to play a violin, which is very, very, very interesting. Of course, a lot of the young people in Northern Ireland after the 70s were becoming more and more interested in rock, punk rock and rap and so on. But the Irish folk music remained very popular. The Chieftains, you can find them on YouTube. The other important group, the Dubliners, I also have a bit from the Dubliners. Another Irish tradition, yeah? In heaven there is no beer. That's why we drink it here. Yeah? You need to drink as much as you can, because when you're dead you can't drink anymore. Tradition of Irish drinking songs. Okay, let's get back to the history to some extent. The 1980s, so this conflict continues. This conflict continues. There are IRA bombs in Manchester, IRA bombs in London. Attacks on Catholics in Belfast. You know, it's not a pretty situation. And the next big episode is when Margaret Thatcher is Prime Minister of England, and this is a hunger strike. That is to say, if you remember, the many of the Republican prisoners are in prison without a trial. And so they say, the Republican prisoners say, we are political prisoners. And so we refuse to wear prison uniforms like a criminal. So it's a symbol. Of course, a uniform is a uniform. Yeah. So we refuse to wear prison uniforms like a criminals, and we refuse to do prison work like criminals. We're not criminals. Okay. And at the beginning, in the 1970s, this was accepted. But little by little, the governments, and in particular the Conservative government, said, no, they are criminals. No, they are criminals. They must wear prison uniform. And the prisoners discussed and had a campaign and said, no, we refuse to wear prison uniform. And so the prison authorities said, in which case, you will have no clothes. And the prisoner said, okay, that's life. And so they had the blanket from the bed. Years and years, many years, they only had the blanket. And then the prison authorities said, if you're not wearing prison uniform, you cannot go to the toilets. And you cannot wash. Okay? And the prisoners said, well, you know, okay. We are not wearing prison uniforms. And so they continued with a protest. They were not allowed to wash or go to the toilets. And so they lived in their cells as best they could. Apparently, if you spread shit on the walls, it dries and it's a little bit more livable. But not fun. Yeah, not fun. I don't recommend it. So, very, very high level of symbolic and physical, very violent prisons, of course. And their final act was a hunger strike. They organised a hunger strike in... The first hunger strike was in 1980. And the second hunger strike in 1981. Ten prisoners died of hunger. And there were international campaigns in support of the hunger strikers. And Margaret Thatcher was criticised for not wanting to negotiate. And Bobby Sands is the first of the prisoners to die. And so here is, a mural in support for him. Now, in some ways, the hunger strike was a political victory for the Republicans, because the British government and Margaret Thatcher said, they are criminals, they have no support. And at that moment, accidentally, one of the members of parliament for Northern Ireland died. And there was a new election, une élection partielle, and Bobby Sands was candidate, and he won. So he became, he got the majority of the votes. He became a member of the British Parliament while he was on hunger strike. So, of course, this was a very big political victory for him, because the British government would say, they have no support. I was elected Member of Parliament, hello. Yeah. So that was a very, very powerful political thing. When he died, more than 100,000 people attended the funeral, eventually 10 people died altogether, and then the hunger strike was ended. The families of the other hunger strikers decided to end it. Brings you with a difficult political question: defeat or victory? On the one hand, of course, it was a defeat because Margaret Thatcher did not retreat. On the other hand, a few years later, all of the demands of the prisoners were accepted. They didn't wear prison uniform, they didn't do prison work, etc. Okay, now, the history of Northern Ireland after the hunger strike, after 1981, is less depressing. Okay, things get better. And I will explain to you next week about things getting better, so, you know, don't get too depressed from now till then. Thank you for your attention, and I will see you next week. Don't forget, the test will be on the 17th.